Okay. Welcome, everyone. Good to see everyone. Good to see you, Melanie. That's right. Maybe I should just start off by explaining why I was... By the way, the computer here is not for Zoom. I'm not doing Zoom today, only... But it's... when we used to do it, as always Facebook Live, so I'm keeping the Facebook Live, but that's just for people who are far away. Just to explain why I'm so pushy about people coming back to learn.
Wow.
Sorry?
Interesting.
So I don't know if you watched my little video, but I'll just repeat the point of it. The point of it is that in Yiddishkeit, there's a tradition that we need to, although the goal of Yiddishkeit is to make our homes into places of holiness, but we only do that when we first connect with a place of pure holiness. And we see this from when the Jews left Mitzrayim. When they left Mitzrayim, so we find that they brought a Korban Pesach, right? And every time you bring a Korban, a sacrifice, normally in the Beit HaMikdash, you always need to sprinkle the blood on the Mizbeach, right? So in Mitzrayim, there was no Mizbeach, there was no Beit HaMikdash. So where did they sprinkle the blood? On the doorposts, right? And the idea is that we taught that the lesson is because Hashem wanted to teach us that the ultimate goal is to actually make our homes into the Beit HaMikdash, right? However, later on, when they went into Israel, or even in the desert, actually, in the Mishkan, they were only allowed to bring a korban in the Beis HaMikdash, right? They weren't allowed to bring a korban at home. The reason for that is because in order to turn our homes into Beis HaMikdash, we have to always go and visit and connect to places of pure holiness. That's why it's so important to come to a place of learning. There's also the concept of learning in a group. Pirkei Avos tells us that there's a special power of learning in a group, connecting with other people, connecting through other people with the Torah, with Hashem, and so on and so forth. So we're trying to get everyone back. Everyone is out and about. Hashem gave us back the opportunity. Everyone is in restaurants, in gyms, in everywhere. So there's no reason they shouldn't be here learning. So that's why I'm pushing. Zoom is a good thing. We'll still keep some things on Zoom. It was a great idea, the Zoom. Like for the sort of lightweight nighttime things we'll keep on Zoom, like the shmooze and these kind of things. And some shiurim will be partly here, partly Zoom, but I thought we'll take a few good, the traditional learning shiurim and try and push everyone to come. So, welcome. All right, so this week's parasha is Tazria Metzora. You've got your handout there. Those who want a handout, it's right here. Just a little bit of an overview, first of all. You can see on the front of your handout. So really, it's a double parasha, Tazria and Metzora. And the overview is really four things. So at the beginning of the parasha, we have the laws of childbirth and the impurity that comes with childbirth, that a woman has to go through a purification process in order to become pure again. Right? Then we have a very large bulk of the parasha dealing with the laws of tsaras, of leprosy, which we'll talk about soon. Three types of tsaras, three types of leprosy. The leprosy of the body, the leprosy of clothing, and the leprosy of buildings, right? Then we have in the second part of the parasha, which is Metzora, we have the purification process. How does one become pure from tsaras? And there's a whole journey, the whole process of sacrifices and rituals that the Torah gives us in order for the people to become pure from tsaras, from leprosy. And then at the end of Metzora, at the end of the parasha, we get taught a bunch of different other bodily impurities, the laws of Nidon, this parasha, Zav, Zava, Keri, and so on and so forth. All types of bodily impurities, which the Torah discusses at the end of the parasha. Quite a technical and complicated parasha. Okay. So I wanted to share with you essentially three things today. One is just a short thing on the beginning of the parasha, and then the bulk and the sort of about tsaras, and a little bit about the purification process. Let's have a look. I'll put it all in your handout. It's on the handout. Number one, as you see, Perek 12, Perek Yudbeis, Pasuk 1 to 3. So we learn the laws of childbirth. So it says, Vayadaber Hashem el Moshe lemer. And Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu, saying, Daber el Bnei Yisrael, speak to the Jewish people. Lemer saying, Isha ki Sazria. Isha ki Sazria, a woman who conceives v'yolda zohar and gives birth to a male, to a son. V'tomei shivas yomim, She will then become impure, first of all, for 7 days, kamei nidas tevoisa titma. For those 7 days, she will be exactly the same as the status of a woman who is in nida. Then the Torah sort of almost randomly inserts, by the way, halacha, which we'll see in a minute, ubayoyim hashmini yimol besar or losoi. On the 8th day, the child should be circumcised. Then, ushloish, I'm going to explain what the next pasuk means in a minute, but it says, here we are, sorry, I should have put them at the back, sorry, I'll try next time. Ushloishim yoim ushloishes yomim, then for another 33 days, up until 40 days. Teishe bidmei tahara, she should be in a state of blood purification, which the Torah, that's where the Torah, at that point she's not permitted to touch and to eat something that's holy, which means truma, and I'll explain in a minute. But amigdosh leisovei, she cannot go into the Beis HaMikdosh, ad meloisimei tahara. Okay. So essentially what this is all about is, as we've talked about this in previous years, there's a purification process which a woman has to go through when she gives birth. We've talked about before that the whole concept of impurity always comes in the Torah when there's a vacuum of life, and there's loss of life and a vacuum of life. Interestingly, when a woman gives birth, it's obviously a happy time and a great time and an amazing time, but there's still a loss of life. In other words, for her, she carried a certain life with her for 9 months, which she no longer has. The life is still there, and it's a thriving life, and it's a beautiful life. But the fact that she doesn't have that life anymore with her causes a certain impurity, and therefore she needs that purification process, right? When a woman gives birth to a girl, it's a double the time. So it says you have 7 days, that's 14 days. When it says you have 33 days, that's 66 days. Why? Some of the first should explain, because when a woman's gives birth to a child and that life is no longer within her, the stronger the life, the greater the vacuum. A girl is stronger life than a boy, because a girl, it's herself is potential to give birth. So that's why a girl sort of is considered a double life that she's lost, so to speak. And therefore the impurity process is actually longer. Okay, but I'm not going to go into that today. Just show you, before I share with you an interesting socha chava, just a little cute thing. One of the Mefarshim, one of the commentaries on Chumash is the Balaturim. The Balaturim always has gematrias and different interesting ways to look at the Psukim. So you know, it's interesting that when the Torah over here talks about the laws of childbirth, it's got nothing to do with the laws of circumcision here, but the Torah inserts the Pasuk, like we just learned in the second Pasuk, over the third Pasuk, Vayoyim Hashmini, that on the 8th day, the child should be circumcised, right? Talking about the boy. Why does the Torah repeat this? We already have the mitzvah of Bris Milah a long time ago in Parashas Lech Lecha with Avraham Avinu. Many, many reasons. One reason is that we learn extra halachas from the repetition, right? One of the halachas we learn from the repetition of the Bris Milah mitzvah in this Parsha is that Bris overrides Shabbos. We know the famous thing. So if a boy is born and the 8th day is Shabbos, it overrides it, because it says, Ubayoyim Hashmini, and on the 8th day, repeat it, because we already know it's the 8th day. But repeats it on the 8th day, which means it always has to be on the 8th day, even if it's Shabbos, right? So the Balaturim points out an interesting thing. He says that this pasuk, if you have a look at it, Vayoyim Hashmini Yimol Basar Or Losai, on the 8th day, he should be circumcised. The number of letters in that pasuk, apparently, I didn't count it up, but I trust him. The number of letters in that pasuk is the same as the number of letters in the pasuk Vayechulu Hashemayim Va'aretz V'chol Tzva'am that we say in Kiddush Friday night, right? That's the first time the Torah talks about Shabbos. To tell us, yeah, you got that? So same amount of letters in the two pasukim. To tell us that when there's a bris takes place, even if it's Vayechulu Hashemayim Va'aretz V'chol Tzva'am, even if it's on Shabbos. It's amazing, right? While we're on that already, I'll tell you something else he says in the pasuk. We know that bris milah is a mitzvah of a daytime. We have in halacha, we have daytime mitzvahs and nighttime mitzvahs. And normally the rule is that when you have a daytime mitzvah, although it's a mitzvah to do it as early as possible, nevertheless, the mitzvah is the entire day. So he says the next part of the pasuk, the first few words of the pasuk, which is Ubayoyim Hashmini Yimol Besar, on the 8th day his skin shall be circumcised, has the same gematria as Shakol Hayom Yiyah Kasher Lamul, which means the whole day is kosher to circumcised. Okay, that's just an interesting little thing. Now, I'll just share with you a bit of insight here that the Sochet Shavah, the Shem Yishmael, I've often quoted from the Sochet Shavah, and he says an interesting thing just because it gives it a bit more relevance to the time of year we're in. Because Tazria and Metzora, not mamush always, but most times, is read after Pesach. And I say not always because when it's a leap year, like next year, I'm not sure what the parshas pan out, but sometimes you read Metzora before Pesach. But most of the years it's after Pesach, in between Pesach and Shavuos. And we know that the Shalach HaKadosh says, as we often mention, that the parshas always have a connection to the time we're in, even though we read them in order of the parsha, but there's always some hashgacha pratis. So he says that this process he brings is very much connected with the preparation of the Jewish people for the giving of the Torah. So let's just understand how the process was. So he focuses on the boy halacha. So when a woman gives birth to a boy, there are three stages. There's a stage of seven days, then there's the concept of 40 days, 7 and 33, and then this is what happens after the 40 days. What is that? So there are three stages. For the first 7 days after birth, the woman is considered still in the state of a nida, which means that she's got a quite significant level, you could say, of impurity, which makes intimate relations with her husband forbidden, and like all the laws of nida, right? After that, she can go to mikveh, and then she can resume relations, although it's not done that way today. Today, she waits until she's completely recovered, but that's the biblical law. So that's the halacha of the first 7 days. The next period of 40 days, she loses that level, that severe level of tumah, but still has a degree of impurity which prevents her from eating truma. So truma, we know, is the first separation of produce in Eretz Yisrael, which is holy. It's given to the Kohen. If the Kohen is married, his wife may eat the Truma as well. Now, only a Kohen and his family is permitted to eat Truma. The Truma food is considered extremely holy. One's not allowed to eat it when you're impure, when it has to be completely pure. It has to be completely pure, and it can only be eaten by a Kohen and the family, right? Which means his wife, his children, and so on. When I say his wife, I mean even though his wife's technically not a Kohen, because a regular Yisrael is not allowed to eat truma, but a wife that's married to a Kohen is allowed to eat truma, but only if she's completely pure. So in this particular process of a woman giving birth to a child, for 40 days she's prevented from eating truma. Right? After the 40-day period, she loses that level of truma, and she can eat truma. What she cannot do yet is she cannot go into the Beis HaMikdash, which is the highest level of holiness, right? Until she brings a certain sacrifice. There's a certain korban in terms of the Beis HaMikdash that a woman who gave birth to a child has to bring a korban. And once that korban, once the sacrifice is brought, then she's completely pure on all levels and she can even go into the Beis HaMikdash. So he says like this, based on the Arizal, Shem Yishmul says the following. Based on the Arizal says that the going out of Egypt, the Geula, the redemption from Egypt, is compared to the concept of childbirth. Now this is based on a lot of concepts. We know that Yecheskel HaNavi tells us that when the Jews left Egypt, that was the Leidat Am Yisrael, that was the birth of the Jewish nation. So the idea of the Jewish nation being born, that's a concept of Yetzias Mitzrayim. We also know the concept of Chevlei Leida, that the very severe oppression and slavery leading up to the redemption of Mitzrayim is likened to the concept of birth pangs. So there's a lot of analogy, a lot of comparison, not only made by Mitzrayim, by the way, it's also got to do with the coming of Mashiach. We talk about the golus, the exile, being compared to a state of pregnancy, when the baby exists but is not fully functional, so too we're in golus. We exist as a nation, but our level of consciousness is not the same, and so on and so forth, right? And Geula, when the Mashiach finally comes, will be compared to the concept of birth. But he says that the Sochet Shavah, his father, the Shem Yishmul's father, who was then the Sochet Shavah Rebbe, pointed out that therefore we can take, doesn't work exactly to the day, but we can take a similar process that we see these three stages of what a woman goes through after she gives birth to a child, that's very compared to the three stages of after the birth of Klal Yisrael, how they prepared for the giving of the Torah. How so? So when they went out of Egypt, for the first 7 days, similar to the 7 days, they were still connected to the impurity of Mitzrayim. As long as Mitzrayim was still around, and as even though there was a tremendous redemption, a tremendous birth, right, that took place on the night of Pesach, but as long as the Egyptians and Pharaoh were still around and still had the potential to recapture them, as almost happened, so to speak, at the Red Sea, right? And to still dominate them and to cause them to be scared and so on and so forth, that means they were still attached to the impurity of Mitzrayim, which we read about nowadays also. Every single Pesach, when we re-experience the concept of Yetzias Mitzrayim, we are taught when is the ultimate Yetzias Mitzrayim, the personal freedom. Of course, it happens at the beginning of Pesach. When does it finally happen? On Shvi'ish or Pesach, the seventh day of Pesach, when we commemorate the Kriyat Yamsuf, the splitting of the Red Sea. That's the final break, so to speak, from Mitzrayim, right? So therefore, similar to the first 7 days of childbirth, where the tumah, where the impurity is sort of on a higher level, that was also when the Jews went on Mitzrayim. First 7 days, they were still attached to Mitzrayim, and it took 7 days until Paroi came and pursued them, and the sea split, and that great revelation of the sea splitting. It wasn't just the sea splitting, it was also a tremendous gilui, a tremendous revelation that took place when the sea split, and Paroi and the Egyptians were finally punished, and they disappeared, and they were drowned. That was the final break, not only physically, but final break spiritually, from the impurity of Mitzrayim, which detached them from the impurity of Mitzrayim. Okay. But, as a nation, they were now detached from Mitzrayim, but they were not ready for the giving of the Torah. They had to be refined. So the next 40 days, the 40-day concept, which is, if you take from the beginning of the Omer till Rosh Chodesh Sivan, which is the day that they arrived at Har Sinai, that's 40 days, more or less, right? So therefore, that 40-day period is like when they couldn't eat truma. They weren't impure, but they couldn't engage with something holy just yet. They had to work on themselves. That's the 40-day period, similar to the second period of the woman giving birth. What happened on Rosh Chodesh Sivan? They arrived at Har Sinai. They arrived at Har Sinai. It was a game changer. Everything changed. Everything changed. By Yichan Sham Yisrael, they united there. They camped there as one person, as one heart, and so on and so forth. And they kind of were ready for Matan Torah, almost. Almost. They were ready. They were ready to commit. They were ready. They said, Naseh, we're going to do it, everything like that. But it wasn't quite Matan Torah yet. They couldn't go into the Beis HaMikdash. They could eat Truma, but they couldn't go into the Beis HaMikdash. Until the 5th of Sivan. And the 5th of Sivan is when they brought, as we read in the Chumash, as a preparation of the giving of the Torah, they brought korbanos, they brought sacrifices. And they immersed in a mikveh. And when they brought sacrifices, that one was when the woman got to the final stage, that she brought the sacrifice, she was now ready to go into the Beis HaMikdash. The final stage of the Omer was the bringing of the sacrifices. The Omer completed, they were now ready to go into the Beis HaMikdash, the ultimate connection with Hashem. And Matan Torah took place the very next day. So that's a beautiful insight of how this seemingly specific law of the Torah to do with childbirth, much of which is not even kept today, in its form the way the Torah is kept, but it really relates very, very much to the time of the year that we read it in, or read it most years at least, and that is the whole preparation period. It reminds us that the time we're in now is very much a time of preparation, a time of the Omer, a time of purification, a time of refinement, leading up to the ultimate purity of the giving of the Torah after we come out of Mitzrayim. Okay. Let's go to the next part of the parasha. Next part of the parasha is a complicated part of the parasha, the halachas of tzaras, halachas of leprosy. Let's have a look. You look at number 2 in your handout. So we just read a few psukim. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe. You'll see at the beginning of this pasuk, in copying and paste from the program, I forgot the vav. So it's Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe vel Aaron lemar. And Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aaron saying, if you don't turn over the page. So we learn, Adam ki yiyeh b'oyr b'soroy, if a person will have on their skin of their body, se'eis, sapachas, or baheris, the old types of rashes, and white something or other. V'hoyo b'oyr b'soroy l'nega tzaras, and they will develop on their skin a plague of tzaras. Now we translate it as leprosy, but it's not leprosy, right? We've gone through that many times. I'll explain in a minute. V'huva el Aaron, he will be brought to Aaron, ha-kohen, Oy el achad mi bonov hakoyanim, or to one of Aaron's sons. In other words, he has to go to a kohen. So what is this? Just to summarize, there was a disease which no longer exists. It was a skin discoloring, meaning it was manifested in the skin discoloring, called tzaras, commonly translated as leprosy for some reason. But as the Mefarshim point out, it was not leprosy. It was actually more of a spiritual disease. It was a very strange disease, tzaras. It was a actually a spiritual disease which has some expression on the physical body. Something like that, on the skin, right? And it has very different shades of white and can develop on a person, and the person as a result, if it's in fact diagnosed as tsaras, the person becomes tomei, quite a severe level of tumah, actually, of impurity, right? The Sepharno points out that it's not a natural disease. The Akedah says an interesting thing. He says, because it doesn't work the way natural disease works, because the first stage of diagnosis was to quarantine the person in a very sort of closed and damp area, which, and then sometimes would suddenly clear up, which most diseases get worse in front of such conditions. And he gives a few examples that actually doesn't work like a natural disease does, and therefore it's some sort of supernatural thing which was manifested in the physical form in the body, right? Which the Al-Sheikh points out is exactly why we don't have it today, right? That's why we don't have it today, because we're not on that level. We don't have tzaras today. Sorry? First of all, we'd all have it. That's a simple shot. But he actually says something different, because actually, I'll pick Kabbalah, that tzaras is actually, we'll see later, I'll talk about it in different contexts. But he says that it is actually sometimes when a person has, some level of transgression. It's not because we all have it, and if Hashem does a kindness, he explains it a bit differently. He says, because the tzaras came because of Lashon Hara, it became because of transgression, it used to be that people were on a high level that when they transgressed, their existence couldn't tolerate the transgression, and therefore expelled it to the outside skin, right? Which is sort of, always a good thing. In other words, it's expelled to the outside because the inside couldn't tolerate it. Unfortunately, today our insides obviously could tolerate it, so it doesn't get expelled to the outside, right? But so it's not a natural thing. But essentially, right? Essentially, what happens is, he goes to the Kohen. The Kohen examines it. Sometimes there has to be a period of quarantine to see what happens, if it spreads, and so on and so forth. And then eventually, the Kohen might diagnose it as tzaras and proclaim the person impure. What happens to the person who's impure? Okay. What happens is that person has to be isolated. Bodod yeshiv. It has to be isolated. Right? Complete social distancing in the ancient form, right? Quarantine, social distancing, the works. Yeah, exactly. Right? Now, why is that? One of the reasons, of course, we know, as Rashi explains, because one of the reasons that tzaras comes is because of Lashon Hara. Right? Lashon Hara means is division. It causes division. In other words, the person who got tzaras created isolation. As we talked about in a Thursday morning, not so long ago, that isolation doesn't mean necessarily physical isolation, right? You can be in a room with someone and be very divided from them, right? You can cause conflict and division even with people. So the person who spoke Lashon Hara caused division, caused isolation in the true sense of the word, loneliness and isolation, conflict, division. And therefore the punishment has to be isolation, essentially, right? Okay. Now, the person who has tzaras has such a high level of impurity that the impurity is extremely contagious. Now, when I say contagious, I use the word contagious because the laws of purity and impurity are very complex. They're particularly complex today because we don't relate to it, because it's very abstract, because we don't live that way anymore. We don't. Laws of purity and impurity are not that relevant anymore in terms of going into the Beis HaMikdash. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash. We don't eat terumah. We don't eat sacrificial meat. If we're not so, we don't experience the laws of purity and impurity a lot. They used to. In olden times, people were much more familiar with them. Today, it's much more of an academic exercise where we learn all these about these things. But it's quite, there's different levels of tumah. It's like really, right? And different things can become tumah and so on and so forth. So the way different things conduct, certain things are easier to contract tumah than others. And also there's different levels of contagion, essentially, I guess is the best word to use, in terms of how impurity can be spread, can be transmitted from one thing, one person to another, or from a person to a thing, to food, to vessels, and so on and so forth. Okay. So why did I say that? Because there's a halacha that if a person who has tzaras walks into someone's house, right? By being in the house, he can transmit the impurity to all the utensils in the house. Which is a disaster, actually, because that would mean that the person who's who's got kelim in the house has to then take everything to the mikveh, because in those days you'd have to do. If something was tameh, you'd have to, only way it could become pure is by going to a mikveh, right? And if it was earthenware vessels, it would be even more disastrous, because there's no mikveh, you have to actually break them. So be a problem, right? So there's such a concept that's how strong the level of impurity is by tzaras, that a person who's a metzora, who has tzaras, walks into a house, everything in the house becomes tameh. Okay? Now, I'm going to learn with you a Mishnah. And I'm going to tell you why I'm going to learn with you a Mishnah. Because, again, the practical application of these laws is very difficult today. Right? We don't have tzaras. We don't observe most of the laws of purity and impurity. But nevertheless, as the Rambam points out, every one of these laws have lessons. Every one of these laws have significance and have relevance, right? So I'm going to learn with you a Mishnah, and I'm going to teach you then an explanation of the Mishnah. The Mishnah is purely halachic, technical, but obviously, as we know, Torah comes on many levels, as we've talked about many, many times. And I'm going to share with you an insight in this Mishnah, which comes from Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, the father of the Lubavitch Rebbe, who was a great Kabbalist. He says something very short on this Mishnah, and then there was a famous Sicha, talk from the Rebbe, where he developed this idea and gave an unbelievably beautiful explanation of this Mishnah on a spiritual level, which will be something we can take away and apply to our own lives. Let's have a look. So I said like this. Let's have a look at this Mishnah. It's number 3 on your handout. Says the Mishnah, Metzora, a leper, someone who has tzaras, shenichnas lebayis, who went into a house, right? Kol hakelim sheyesh tom tmeim. All the utensils, all the vessels that are in the house become tomei. Afilu ad hakoyros, all the way up to the top of the house. That's one opinion. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, adal at amos, no, only to a certain height. Okay, that's not what I'm going to talk about. Then says the Mishnah the following. Kelim miyad tmeim. All the utensils in the house, as soon as the leper walks into the house, immediately all the kelim become tame. Everything in the house becomes, the whole house becomes impure, essentially. Yeah? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, no. Im shoha kedei hadlokas nef. Only if the person who has leprosy remained in the house more than it takes, more than the time it takes to light a candle. Mm-hmm. So he says, more than the time it takes to light a candle. Meaning, if he exited the house, right, during the time it takes to light a candle, then he has not impurified the house. Now the simple pshat of that's Rabbi Huda's opinion, which is the opinion we're going to focus on. Right? Now the simple reason for that is because the person lighting the house, the person lighting the candle. The person lighting the candle can't tell him to leave. See, the halacha is if someone has tzaras, walks into my house, and I say, no, you don't have permission to be here, get out. Then, and he gets out, then the house doesn't become tameh. It's really about staying there with my permission. So Rabbi Yehuda says you have to give the guy a chance. You have to give the guy a chance to tell him to get out, right? So what happens if he was busy doing something? And the example he gives is, let's say he was busy lighting a candle, so give him a chance to finish lighting the candle and tell him to go out. Right? So that's a simple halachic explanation of the Mishnah. So Rabbi Yehuda says there's a period of time which we have to give the owner of the house to instruct the guy to leave. If that time passed and he still didn't instruct him to leave, and therefore the person is in the house longer than that time, then the house becomes impure. But otherwise, if he was only in the house less than that time, the house doesn't become impure. Okay. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak says, and then, as I said, the Rebbe takes the whole new level, but I'll just tell you what he says. It's a bit technical from a Kabbalistic point of view, but let me explain it. He says, we know that we have different layers of our personality, correct? To use the Kabbalistic phraseology, we've got what we call seichel, we have our intellect, we have our midas, we have our emotions, And we have the lowest form, the bottom rung of our personality is called Malchus. Right? Malchus, which means leadership. Malchus essentially means our behavior. It's the way we function. Right? In other words, it's the part of us that absorbs what we feel, absorbs what we think, and then uses that to respond to the outside world. Does that make sense? I've said that very quickly. Yeah? Okay. Kabbalistically, the concept of a house being a place that houses everything, when we talk about the concept of a bayis, that's synonymous with the concept of malchus. Okay? Yep. So think of a house. Let's try and sort of apply this to ourselves, right? The house part of our existence is the part of us that houses everything else of us. It's the part that houses our emotions, the part that houses our intellect, the part that applies it all, right? That's Malchus. That same idea of Malchus, right? We know 10 layers of the personality. Malchus hasn't got its own personality. Malchus is like the receptacle. It receives and absorbs everything about us and then puts it into practice. That's the part of us. Malchus is the part which is very susceptible to impurity. Right? The way we respond, the way we behave, the way we express ourselves, that's where we do the most damage. Right? What happens internally can be damaging, but that's not where the damage happens. The spiritual damage happens. Where does the spiritual damage happen mostly? In the way we experience life. The spiritual damage happens mostly in our house, in Malchus. The way we respond to other people, not obviously the way we respond sometimes is an emotional concept, but it's how we express that emotion, right? In other words, I'll give you an example. If you say something not nice to me and I feel very hurt but I don't respond, I haven't done damage, right? In other words, if I work through, I might feel very, very hurt, but if I work through it, I just make a choice not to respond, I have a normal conversation, I work through it properly, I haven't done any damage. My emotions were hurt, but I haven't done damage because my malchus is working properly. Yeah? But if I let it go and I take that emotion of hate or revenge and I explode and I start to scream and shout and hurt you back and insult you, which is malchus, in other words, I'm behaving now, I'm expressing myself, I'm applying my emotion, that's where the damage happens. Right? How can we make sure, and this is something we've talked about so often, what protects the malchus from becoming impure? The wisdom, the intellect, chokhmah. Right? As we know, between stimulus and response is a pause. Pause is there for us to think and make the right decision. If we have a clarity of mind, right? If we have clarity of mind, and therefore we have clarity of mind and we illuminate our existence with proper thinking, then we don't impurify the house. If we don't think, and we let the rest of us just take its course, Malchus acts alone, Malchus is unhinged, untamed, it just takes the emotion of the moment, responds, behaves badly, spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, whatever the case is, it becomes impure. Right? So therefore again, the house, I'm clear? The house of our existence, Malchus, is where tumah, where impurity happens. When is Malchus protected from impurity? When there's clarity of mind. Right? Says Reb Levi Yitzchak, lighting a candle, the light bulb is a symbol kabbalistically of bringing down the light of Chochmah, the light of wisdom, right? Particularly in intellect, when you talk about the mind, particularly that level of the mind which is called Chochmah, because you know the mind has three parts, Chochmah, Bina, and Das, but Chochmah is what we call the truth of the mind. It's the clarity, it's the light bulb which goes on, which gives me the clarity of truth of the situation. Yeah? Then I can develop it through Bina and Das and so on. So when you light the candle protects the bias from getting tummy. Right? That was how Reb Levi Yitzchok explained the Mishnah. But if someone who has tzaras, who has tumah, there's a potential for impurity, and that impurity has great potential of messing up the entire house, right? Once there's a potential for impurity, the tumah can then be so contagious that it can then impurify the entire house. In other words, it can do damage, spiritual damage to the malchus. When can it do it? Only if you're there longer than it takes to light a candle. But if you're there while the candle is being lit, it doesn't impurify the house. Okay. That's what Levi Yitzchak said. Well, if he walks up before, yeah, while the candles be lit, sort of, exactly. So the Rebbe, quoting his father in a talk, and the talk is actually, it's a combination of two talks from 76 and 75, right? I'll just give you the year, because it was also a time, and you'll see why he took this. It was also a time when the Rebbe had launched a campaign to get all women and girls to make sure they light Shabbos candles. Right? There's a major, major campaign which they never made in those years to ensure that everyone should light Shabbos candles. He said it's the call of the hour to make sure that the world is illuminated by Shabbos candles to light on time and so on and so forth, right? So that's why I think that's what motivated this particular talk also. So he says like this. He says, what do you mean? We still haven't explained why it's specifically to do with a candle. The example is a candle. And also, why is it specifically got to do with the impurity of tzaras? Right? In other words, there's this general concept, right? Impurity, the house becoming impure, which is the concept of malchus becoming impure, right? Our functionality, our behavior becoming impure. The only way to protect that impurity is through the light of the wisdom, the clarity of wisdom. So he says, okay, so therefore you won't make the house impure unless you have clarity of the mind, right? Chochmah. Good. But the Rebbe always liked everything to be 100% exact. He says, but hold on a second, which impurity are we talking about here? Specifically, the impurity to do with tzaras. Right? What's the significance of that? Why specifically tzaras? Why specifically the impurity of leprosy? So he went on to explain the following. I'll do my best to make it clear. And he said like this. There's a fascinating commentary on that Mishnah that actually says that the example the Mishnah is giving about the time that it takes to light a candle is specifically talking about the candles of Shabbos. Now, that's huge. That's a huge innovation, because the truth is that in those times when we talk about lighting candles, today we light candles normally Shabbos, right? Or a simcha. We don't just light candles every day. Those days, people lit candles every day. I mean, there was no electricity, right? So when it says, when a person walks into a house and we talk about, we want to pick a time frame, and we talk about a time frame that it takes to light a candle, that's a very normal, relevant analogy in those days, right? Because people are always lighting candles in those days. Yet the Tiferes Yisrael brings a commentary and he says, actually, it's a specific reference to Shabbos. He says, you know why? He proves it because he says, the whole idea is that while the person is lighting the candle, he doesn't have time to tell the guy to get out of the house, right? So the commenters say, why not? You can light a candle, you can say a person leave at the same time. He says, no, because we're talking about Shabbos candles. And Shabbos candles, you can't stop in the middle. It's a mitzvah. You got to finish the mitzvah. You can't talk in the middle, right? So whatever the proof is, he says that the Mishnah is talking about Shabbos candles. Oh, now, so let's develop this. And let's talk about Shabbos candles, what Shabbos candles represents, right? And then talk about what Saras represents. We'll put everything together and you'll see it all makes sense in terms of the concept we said before. We know that Shabbos candles, the Gemara says, why do we need to light Shabbos candles? Why is Shabbos candles so important? So we find an incredible emphasis with Shabbos candles on the concept of Shalom Bais. Right? Why? The simple pshat of the Gemara is that when you light Shabbos candles bring shalom bayis, peace in the home. Because if you don't light Shabbos candles, why do the Chachamim make which light Shabbos candles? Two reasons. Just generally, so it's interesting general knowledge. There are two reasons why the mitzvah of Shabbos candles originated. One is that you light candles in honor of Shabbos, because you know lighting candles is always a symbol of doing something in honor of something. Which is the same reason why we put candles by a bris or by a chasana, why we have candles and walk to a chuppah. When you want to honor something, you light candles. But more importantly, you had to light Shabbos, which is why we do it nowadays mainly, because nowadays we have electricity anyway, so we can see. But really, it was different. The Chachamim said, you have to light Shabbos candles, so there should be peace in the home, it shouldn't be dark. Don't forget, once night comes, you can't light candles on Shabbos anymore. Therefore, if the Chachamim didn't make a mitzvah, you're obliged to light Shabbos candles before Shabbos comes in, people would sit in the dark, people would trip into each other, there would be conflict in the home. Right? So in order to create a serene, a nice, calm existence in the home on Shabbos, there's a mitzvah to light Shabbos candles before Shabbos comes in. Because when things are light, you could see. And therefore, when you could see, there's much greater calmness, there's much greater serenity, right? The expression that the Gemara uses is, that's an important expression, so bear it in mind, I'll say it and then I'll come back to it soon, that you have to light Shabbos candles, shelo yikoshel ba eitz uba evin. In order that people should not trip over wood and stone. That's the expression it uses. Shouldn't stumble over a piece of wood or a piece of stone. So otherwise it'll be, and people will stumble, they'll get it grumpy, it'll be... So ever since that concept, we know that Shabbos candles is associated, is always connected with the concept of Shalom Bais. Right? Simply because you can see, when you can see, there's a great level for peace. So much so, by the way, that the Gemara by Hanukkah says that as important as Hanukkah candles is, if someone was very poor, right? There were such concepts in those days that the person even couldn't afford candles, right? If someone is very poor and they only have a choice, when it comes Friday night, they can light either Shabbos candles or Hanukkah candles. Which one comes first? Shabbos candles. Because, says the Gemara, Shabbos candles is all about Shalom Bais, and the Torah nitna lasso shalom ba'olam, the Torah was given to make peace in the world. Therefore, Shalom Bais comes first. So the Rebbe raises a very interesting question. He says, you know, when you turn a light, first of all, that's not only Shabbos candles. Anytime you turn on a light, create peace. Second of all, not always when you turn on a light do you make peace. It actually is the other way around. Sometimes when you make it too light, people see things that they shouldn't have to see before. Right? I mean, even a very basic level, right? Can you imagine, I don't know, a parent, it's dark at home and suddenly a light goes on and the mother says to the daughter, you look like this. You didn't manage to, I don't know, brush your hair, right? Or symbolically, when you highlight things, you start to see things that maybe you better not to see before, right? So sometimes lighting a candle is actually not as, who said lighting a candle is a symbol of Shalom Bais? A very interesting question, right? Not your normal typical question, but it's like a more interesting question. Says the Rebbe, obviously, when we talk about lighting Shabbos candles, it's not about the physical light. It's about the light of Torah. In other words, because we have this concept called Ner Mitzvah V'Torah Or. It says that a mitzvah is compared to a candle and the Torah is compared to light, right? So we don't only mean the specific physical light that we're generating. We're talking about the spiritual light. The only problem is we're talking about the spiritual light, so then it's any mitzvah. Why are we talk about Shabbos candles specifically? So he says an interesting thing. He says that sometimes when something spiritual symbolizes something, but it symbolizes it to the point where it even physically works like that, the emphasis is a lot greater. I'll give you an example. So you know, in the Beis HaMikdash, there was a series of miracles that happened, right? The Pirkei Avos says there were 10 miracles that happened every single day in the Beis HaMikdash. One of the miracles that happened was that there was a candle of the menorah, of the candelabra, that was lit every evening and it had enough oil to light the entire night. But one of the candles called the Neir Ma'aravi, the Western candle, the whole machlokes, which one that is, but the Western candle actually burned continuously. So it burned longer than everyone else, everything else, right? Says the Chazal, why is that? It says, Eidus hi leboy olam. It says it's a testimony, witness to the people of the world that the Shechina rests among the Jewish nation. Says, hold on a second. What's a testimony? The fact that there were 10 miracles. Every miracle is a testimony. Why this one? The answer is because this burns as a candle. In other words, it physically shows, not just spiritually. Every miracle is a testimony to the fact that the Shekhinah is among the people. But when you have one of the miracles expressing itself in a candle, that's tremendously emphatic that it's representing, revealing the concept of the Shekhinah. Same thing with all mitzvahs. So all mitzvahs, right? All mitzvahs are like a candle. All mitzvahs bring light into the world, right? All mitzvahs therefore bring peace into the world. Why? Because it says the Torah was given to bring peace. The entire Torah brings peace into the world. But when you have one of the mitzvahs which is specifically represented in a candle and its function is to bring physical light, its spiritual function is that much more emphasized. Now, let's understand, what does this mean to bring light? What does it mean? What's the spiritual shalom bayit that we bring here? What does that mean? What does it mean the Torah came to bring peace to the world? What type of peace are we talking about? Where's the conflict that needs to bring peace? So we know there's a great conflict. The conflict is this. The conflict is that Hashem created a world. He created an existence that, notwithstanding the fact that we know that there's no reality outside of Hashem, beside the fact that we know that everything that exists only exists because of Hashem's creative power. And we know that, as we say in davening every single day, HaMechadesh betuvo b'chol yom tamid ma'aseh b'reishit, that Hashem renews the creation, and if this table didn't have the godly spark keeping it alive, it wouldn't exist, it simply wouldn't exist. However, Hashem created the world in such a way where the world doesn't look that way, as we know. In fact, the world looks like a place which is in conflict with Hashem. The world is a dark place. The world is a place where you cannot see the spark of creation. You cannot see the godly power. You cannot see the connection of every creation to God. You cannot see that the multiplicity of the creation is in fact all part of one power, power of Hashem. Like the analogy we've always given about the orchestra. You cannot see how every single instrument, specific instrument, is really all connected to the one conductor. It's all part of the same symphony. You can't see it. What you do see is conflict. You see the world fighting Hashem. You see the world resisting Hashem. Right? That's what you see. So the world is a place of conflict. What is the Torah there for? Why is the Torah called Torah Or? Because Torah Or is to illuminate the world. It's an illuminating power. When you learn Torah, and Torah teaches you that that's not true, Torah teaches you to look beyond the darkness. Torah turns on the candle for you, Torah turns on the light for you, and you see that Hashem's creative power in everything that exists. You suddenly see that there's actually no conflict, and there's no multiplicity. It's all part of one symphony. It's all part of one process. It's all part of one power. It's all godly. It's all godly, and it will be used for God's purpose. It will be used for the service of God. And suddenly there's shalom, there's peace between God and His world, so to speak. Because there is no conflict anymore. Where do we find this with tremendous emphasis? By Shabbos. Shabbos in general, before we get to Shabbos candles, Shabbos is this concept. Shabbos is when we stop. Shabbos is a time when we're supposed to lift up the world and see the creative force behind the world. So what do? We light Shabbos candles. We have a mitzvah on Shabbos that is physically connected to bringing light. Now listen to this amazing interpretation. And what does the Gemara say? The Gemara says that the reason why we light Shabbos candles is shelo yikashel, you shouldn't stumble on stone and wood. What a strange expression. Why do we say you shouldn't stumble into the table? You shouldn't stumble into each other. You shouldn't stumble on wood and air. And what does that mean? Why wood and stone? You know, we're talking about in the house. I thought you said another paper, right? So he says, let me just find this exact quote. Oh, here we are. It's based on a pasuk in Yirmiyahu Hanavi. Listen to this. It means something else completely. It's based on a verse in Yirmiyahu Hanavi, which where the Yirmiyahu Hanavi is complaining that the people serve avodah zarah. They serve idol worship. And the Navi says like this, Omrim la'etz avi'ata. They say to the piece of wood, you're my father. Ula evan, and they say to the stone, ati ladatoni, you have given birth to me. That's what etz and evan is. Etz and evan is a symbol of idol worship. Now, how does idol worship happen? Idol worship in its purest form is a bizarre form of service where you bow down to a piece of wood or bow down to a piece of stone. But that's not all what Avodah Zarah is about. We all serve Avodah Zarah in a subtle way. Avodah Zarah means when you take the physicality of the world, you take the wood, you take the stone, and you don't understand what it is. You stumble on it. You think you stumble because you think it's something in its own right. It's got a purpose in its own right. It's an entity on its own. That's what it means. So that's what it means, is the depth of that expression. That we have Shabbos candles. Shabbos candles is turning on the spiritual light to make shalom bayit, to make peace between Hashem and His world, to show there's no conflict. Because the stone is not its own thing, and the piece of wood is not its own thing. And it has no purpose on its own. It's all part of Hashem's reality. So you turn on the switch, shelo yikashel, you shouldn't stumble and get caught and trapped in the pursuit of stone and wood for its own purpose, as we so often do. But when we learn the lesson of Shabbos, we turn on the switch, then lo yikashel, you won't stumble on the wood and the oven. And therefore there'll be peace. When you stumble on the wood and the stone, when you think it's a thing in its own right, and it's there to enjoy in this pursuit of pleasure because the world is seen as something separate from God, all we land up is with conflict. We have the inner soul which wants to seek our connection with Hashem and seek meaning, and we have our pursuit of running after the things which are stupid and meaningless and empty. And that's an unhappy life. It's a life of conflict. But when you turn on the switch and you realize, no, our whole purpose is to serve one God, Hashem Echad, and the Eitz and the Eved is not something for there to get trapped into. We shouldn't stumble on the Eitz and the Eved. But we should use it out. We should understand the God creative power in the stone and the wood. That it's not something on a stone. It's not a Avodah Zarah. It's something part of Hashem's creation which we can use to serve Hashem. We create an existence of serenity. That everything's part of one purpose. It's one symphony. It's one orchestra. That's what it means. That's the depth of Shabbos. Now let's go back to the guy walking into the house who's a Metzora, who's got leprosy. Why does a person get leprosy? Because he creates conflict, because he creates division. Right? How does a person create division? How does it happen? Same way. The same way we create, the Rambam says that the sin of Lashon Hara is so severe because when you create a conflict between person and person, it's like creating a conflict between us and Hashem. That's what the Rambam says. It's like denying the existence of Hashem. And obviously, what does that mean? Why, just because I'm gossiping about someone else, why does that mean I don't deny, Chas v'Shalom, what does it mean I deny Hashem's existence? Yes, on a certain level. Because conflict means that I'm different to you. Conflict means I'm creating a division between me and you. That I'm better than you, or you better than me, or I'm worse, or I'm less, right? We're focusing on what divides us. We can only focus on what divides us if we don't see the creative power within us. Once we understand that we're all part of Hashem's existence, that's what brings, as we've talked about many times, that's what brings avas Yisrael. That's what brings unity. Division comes because we accentuate the difference between us. There's only difference between two creations if we don't see the conductor, if we don't see the creative power that unites it. The more we understand that we're all part of Hashem's reality, we're all part of Hashem's existence, we're all Hashem's children, we're all created in the image of Hashem, there's no room for division. The leper didn't understand that. He spoke Lashon Hara, he created division, he pushed conflict. And when you push conflict, you bring impurity. You bring impurity to the bias. You bring impurity, you stumble. You stumble and you mess up the malchus, you mess up the behavior, you mess up everything. It's extremely contagious. If you don't have that wisdom, that chokhmah to understand, going back to Levi Yitzchak's thing, to understand the light bulb, to understand the creative power. So therefore, says the Mishnah, if a Metzora walks into a house, specifically the one who has tzaras, not just anyone is tomei, specifically that tumah, because that's the root of other impurities. Specifically that impurity, the one that created conflict and division, that's the one that is so contagious that will just continue to transmit more impurity and more spiritual damage because they don't see the unifying creative power of Hashem. The only protection is the Shabbos candles. The Shabbos candles, which turn on the switch, so we should reflect. I mean, it doesn't just turn on the switch automatically, we have to reflect on it, obviously. It turns on the Shabbos candles so we can reflect, we can understand the Shalom Bayit, that there's no conflict, because Hashem is all of existence. Hashem is the creative power that keeps everything alive. He's the one that brings it all under one banner. And the faster we see that, the faster we get rid of the division impurity of the tzaras. And that's why the person who walks into the house, but he's still under the influence of Shabbos candles, he won't give spiritual damage to the Malchus, and that explains all the details of the Mishnah on a spiritual level. Okay. Welcome back, everyone. See you next week.